Jeanette Armstrong of the Zeeth people of British Columbia. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 ICR in Ithaca, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville.
I just wanted to share my language with you and give you a greeting. I'm giving you greetings from all of my family and my community and my people, the Sielch, and I'm also giving you my thanks that I'm able to come here to share some words with you, and I wanted to thank Jen for the invitation, and I wanted to also acknowledge Leanne and making the contact for Jen. I did prepare an abstract which I sent over, but I'm an oral speaker, and so that's how I want to speak with you. What I want to do is I want to talk about a number of things that may be relevant to the conference here. I want to give you some idea of how I think about giving and the idea of gift, and I want to give you some idea about my own people's understanding of that in terms of the land and the community and the family and also the individual. In order to contribute to this dialogue, because something is really wrong out there, and it's the only thing that I can offer, and the only thing that I can give is my thinking and how it might work and how it might be incorporated or how it might be thought of in terms of the change that needs to happen is all up to you. I come from a small community in southern part of British Columbia in the interior. It's about maybe 200 miles inland from Vancouver, and about the same parallel. My people are sometimes referred to as the Okanagan people, but that's the valley, that's the geographic valley that we live in. We're the Nsiilchin people, we're Siilch, and that's how I refer to myself. The area that I come from has a lot to do with what I'm going to talk about. The area that I come from is one of the only areas in Canada that's considered to be a desert, which means we have very little rainfall during the year because of the two mountain systems that that are on both sides of our valley. And it's very, ecology is very harsh and dry in the summertime. And so that means that the learning that our people have had to accomplish and achieve over many, many generations in order to survive has a lot to do with scarcity and has a lot to do with survival. In a land where there isn't a lot of abundance, and in a land where the fragility of the ecosystem requires absolute knowledge and care, or you overuse it, or you overextend your use of it, it can impact directly on how much you have to eat the next year or the years after in terms of the survival of your coming generation. So a large part of our society and our community and our practice and our philosophy and our governance system are based on understanding that we need to always be vigilant and aware of not overusing, not overconsuming, and always be aware of sharing and giving, and always be aware that we're also, in everything that we're doing, that we're making the same possibility available to our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And so that's really an immense kind of responsibility. And I think of it in terms of direct connection to how the land operates, how the land gives life, and how you as a human being are a part of that. I think that has a lot to do with some things that are wrong from my perspective, that the land is the body that gives continuously, and we as human beings are simply a part of that. And what indigenous means to me is that the interdependence of everything that exists there must be understood, and I must have knowledge about, and I must be able to cooperate with all the other living things on the land so as not to make any one of them extinct or remove any one of them for my need. In other words, to cooperate and to collaborate with every living thing so that they can live and I can live in the same level of health, so that they can continue giving to me and to my children and my children's children the health that they deserve in being a life form. So indigenous to me can't be without that knowledge and that level of cooperation with the land. You cannot call yourself indigenous. This plant here was indigenous somewhere because it could live on its own in an interdependent relationship with its climate, with its land, with its topography. But once you remove it from there, you have to have all kinds of other things to allow it to live, all kinds of other kinds of energy, and work has to be done to make it live. And this plant no longer is indigenous in this pot, in this room, in this place. If you took it out there and put it in the desert where we're at now, this plant wouldn't survive the day. And I think of indigenousness in that way, and I think of the paradigm shift that's required to recover the ability for human beings to live on the land without the kind of the immensity of destructive support systems that are required for this plant or for you. I think of that in terms of the way that all of those systems have been changed in my community in a forced way. I look at community next in that sense. I think about my life, and I think about not only how land gave me my life. Without the Okanagan land, without the Sealik land and all of the relatives that live on that land, every single thing that sustained my people as food, sustained my people as medicine, sustained my people as clothing and shelter, all of those things that surround us, and I can only express in my language what meaning that has to me, and what meaning that has to be unable to protect that, and unable to stand between destruction and those things that are becoming extinguished from that land, because of the depth of love and understanding that's required for us to continue to receive that gift and to continue to honor that gift and respect that gift. It's like family members being assaulted with your hands tied. And that, I can give you that feeling because you can hear it in my voice, is the same with community. is the same with all of the generations of relatives that have sustained each other, interacted with each other in really specific ways to be able to continue life. One of the things about the Nsilikchin people is that we've been described as an egalitarian society, and by some as matriarchal societies. And I don't want to go into the academic discussions about that. I just want to give you some idea of how our community thinks of itself, and how it thinks about what community is. To us, community is a living system, like the land. It's a living diversity of beings, and that diversity is immensely necessary, like the diversity on the land is immensely necessary. There's not one thing on the land that isn't necessary. There's not one thing in the community or one person that isn't necessary. In our understanding of it, it would be like saying, "Well, I don't need my fingernails or I don't need my toes." Just because you don't use your toes every day or your fingernails every day, that every person in the community fulfills a part that may not be understood either in this generation or the next generation or the coming generations, and that in like every diverse being on the land, and that we have no way of determining which is more important or which is less important, and that we never have an understanding in our community members that anyone is actually superior to another. And I think there again I look at how society outside of our traditional community operates, and the idea that there is clearly, my grandmother tried to explain to us in a lot of ways that we would have to find a way to be defensive against this, that there is clearly an understanding that some people have more of a right than others, that some people have more of a priority to things than others, and that some people not only are born with that, but are born with the control of and over that, and that that they live and die with that idea of that privilege, that control, that exclusion of others. And I think that part has always been, for me, a real difficult thing. I relate to people in a really, I guess, in a really different way in a sense, because that's how my community relates. I can't recognize hierarchies, and I don't recognize hierarchies. People are people in terms of how they relate to me. But I notice it on an everyday level. When I go into, say, the community that I live next to in Penticton, depending on how much money you got and how much money you're going to spend, the amount of, respect, and I don't like to use that word because it's a problem for me, the amount of, the amount of respect paid to them is really related not to them, but to their money and to their power and to their ability to spend. And that's so false. And that's so unhuman and against community. That's so much different from our understanding of what respect is in regard to community. In my community, and someone spoke about the idea of chief here earlier, in my community, we have chiefs in our community, women and men. And the idea of chief has to do with how well that person hears everyone. and how well that person understands what is going on that might be wrong, that might be cause conflict, that might cause danger to the people. And then the word itself, ilmichum, means to be able to take the many strands that are moving outward and twine them into one meaning, one people, a unification, a rebalancing with the land. And what that means then is that that person must have an immense ability to feel what the community is saying, an immense ability to listen to the things that have been said and the things that are happening and put that together and say it back to the people. So it's about communication, and it's about being able to listen and being able to put it together in a way which everyone says, yeah, that's it. And it's not telling people what to do or leading people or forcing people. It's in being able to verbalize and communicate what everybody else feels and knows and understands and remembers, and being able to put that together to create a movement forward. And so our systems rely on that kind of relationship and communications in our community systems. There's a process that I'm just going to describe to you really briefly, and I'll give you an example of it. I established an educational program to recover our traditional practices on the land and in our community and our families, called Inalkin. And I've been working at it for 25 years. The idea of Inalkin is a word that comes from our language. Inalkin wich is a word that describes how community should operate in terms of that kind of communication. How community should operate in our mind is to be able to include. It's an inclusion-seeking process, which means that rather than exclude the minority, we're actually trying to find ways to help minority articulate what they're saying, because minorities usually are saying something really different than everybody else. They're the ones that are experiencing something that really differs from others' experience in the community. And whenever there's an issue or a problem, it's that voice that's most needed. And it's the understanding of that voice that's most necessary towards resolvement. And if that voice can't find a way to articulate, can't be heard, can't be listened to, then we're all in trouble. So minority is really an important factor in terms of how our community communicates and listens. So listening is the biggest part, and finding ways to bring forward those really out in the left field, so to speak, kinds of ideas and voices. So Inalkin wich describes that. It's a process in our community that describes a process that makes that happen. We use it in our governance process. We use it in our community dialogues. When we use it in our family circles, our extended family meetings. And the idea isn't to make decisions. The idea is to hear all of the different aspects, all of the different views. So in Inalkin wich, we actually set up a dynamic in which that can happen, and in a dynamic which understands that there are polarities in community because there's diversity. And one of the ways we do that is we try to take the polarities in their larger sense, and we give them context in the community, and we give them authority in terms of that context in the community, which can't be usurped by any other area of community. I'll just describe those four to you that we use in our community. What could be described in our language is something similar to your idea of the elders, maybe. although that's not really a correct term in our language. It means those who have had long experience, and it doesn't mean in years. It really means the teachings from the generations and generations and generations past. So you could be part of that group even if you're 20 years old or 10 years old or 30 years old. It's the knowledge that has been passed on to you and that you express and stand for that makes you tachtachap in our language. And so your thinking and your concerns and your responsibilities are directed towards making sure that everything is remembered that is necessary to make things continue on in a healthy way. That group is usually directly polarized against the group that could be described as the youth, the younger generation, the young people. We think of those in our language as not only people that are young, but people that have a really great urge for innovation and creativity and new things, new ideas, new concepts. And that's always a dynamic that's really needed in any community, in any society, and really encouraged just as the elders and their bringing forward of all their teachings and immense knowledge is really encouraged. But those are the two that's usually a source of oppositional dynamics. So one part of our Anaukanuikwa is a real clear process in which those two speak to each other to inform each other and to clarify for each other. Part of our process for discussion in that Anaukanuikwa process is to something real simple. You start with a concept that if there is a problem or a crisis or something that we're trying to resolve that we don't understand, if anybody in this room already has all the answers and already knows it all, then they should have resolved it. Well, you know, why not? You know, so therefore what that means then, nobody has all the answers. No one person should be arguing for their view, their position, their rightness or whatever. What it means then, everyone should be listening to try to understand what the other is saying and to try to incorporate into the overall solution what everyone is saying so that what everyone is saying, if it's brought together, will make more sense than what I'm saying. And obviously, I didn't resolve it, so what I'm saying isn't that important in terms of by itself. So that premise, to begin with, is a way in which we create the dialogue. We tell people, you're not here to debate. You're not here to enforce your agenda. You're not here to convince me of what you think. You're here to listen and to hear the most diverse and opposite view to yours and to understand where it's coming from and why it's there and why that opinion is important in terms of how we make a solution. You are responsible for doing that. You are responsible for hearing what is the most opposite to your opinion and finding a way to try to incorporate the other's diversity, the other's difference, and embrace that in terms of what we collectively make as a solution so that that difference is no longer a difference. It becomes part of what we are and who we are. And so in terms of the other two dynamics that exist in the community, there's what we call in our language ishkaltumih, the male. In our language, we don't have, in our pronoun structure, we don't have a word that is like he or she. And it's quite a difficult thing to speak English language because everything is sort of, you know, gender sort of based in that way. And I talked with my mother about it, my aunt, Jeanette, who I'm named after, and both are medicine women. And I asked them, well, how come we don't have that? And My aunt looked at me and she said, "Well, it has nothing to do with a person." what does it have to do with a person? She said, "If you were to say he or she in our language, you'd have to point to their genitals. You know, you'd have to point to what's between the legs." She said, "And why would you do that? Why would you talk about a person and point between their legs?" You know, she said, "It doesn't make any sense." And it doesn't. It doesn't. People are what they do and who they relate to and how they relate to the world. And it has nothing to do with gender except that there's males and females. So the word is more like male and female. Skaltamih and tkasmiluh. The word skaltamih actually has to do with how we understand in our philosophy how things work in the world. I guess you'd say the cosmology of things. The way that the word it's constructed for the male is the spreading outward of life as human, the spreading outward of our life form as human. That's the word that we use for male. Tamih is the spreading outward of the life, diversity of life on the land. And for the male, it's skaltamih, meaning the one who's able to dream and able to spread outward the life of the human. And so that aspect or that idea of procreation and the male and the energy behind that is understood as a part of what the male is. And in the same way, the female, the word for female in our language is tkismilu. And it actually is a really interesting word in terms of what I heard here earlier today. The idea of the separating of the part of the skin of the community, the separation into family, is tkismilu. That understanding of tklem means separating out, and milhu is the covering of the community, the skin of the community. That's the whole of the people, the family systems, in other words. So when the family system and which is represented by the female, and the male, which is represented by how the land operates, intersect. The work that has to be done to create balance is to make sure that there's clear understanding between those two dynamics. How the family and people in the family are related to each other based on how they feel about each other, how they treat each other. What society is about feeling, how we care about one another, how we love one another, how we protect one another, how we need to make sure there's food for everyone, how we need to make sure that everyone has, you know, warmth and shelter, and how everyone is nurtured emotionally, how you make people feel good, how you celebrate. All of those aspects are what is understood to be under that the female. And the other aspects of the tmich, the land, the understanding of that is that all of the things that are structurally on the land, all of the living things and all of the things that are required to make shelter, to get food, to develop all kinds of ways and organizing for that and doing that, are all about how things are done, how things get done. In other words, the actions that it takes. So it's action-based. That's why that's spreading out in that word. Everything becomes an action that has to be undertaken, that has to be done. When actions are undertaken and when they're done, they have consequences. In other words, what you do impacts people, right? And if you do things without thinking and understanding and knowing how it impacts people, you can do a lot of things that are destructive, and you do a lot of things that are destructive, thinking that you're doing it in the name of good or the name of providing in the name of prosperity. And if the male aspect gets, you know, its way, that's what it'll do. It'll just keep doing that, because that's what in our society we think of as patriarchy, right? The patriarchal model is where, you know, it doesn't matter that there's people starving. It doesn't matter that there's people hurting. It doesn't matter that there's minorities that are voiceless, you know, that are not being included, that are being excluded. As long as we keep this thing going, so some of the people can get good out of it and some of the people can get privilege out of it. And so that part, I think, is really one of the dynamics that you're talking about here, as well as the other two dynamics, but the dynamic of the male and the female aspects of community, where nurturing and caring for and providing for the feelings, the generations to come, are part of the doing continuously, and that there's clear understanding and there's cooperation and collaboration between both. I'm getting close to what I'm going to end up with here in terms of family systems. That kind of dialogue we call an aukenwich. You cannot sit down and have in our community any kind of rational decision or any kind of rational action unless you include all of those four aspects of dialogue in a deep listening process. If you do, you're endangering the whole community. If you do, you're excluding parts of the community. And in doing that, you are taking a vast risk for the next generations. And I think that's something that, for me, really resonates here, in that we think about how we can continuously give our view, our diverse view, our most opposite opinion, and we think about how we have to listen for the others and how we have to be responsible in putting that together. In terms of the family systems, there is two things that operate within community that I think is important to mention here before I finish here. One is the idea that family systems, like the community, is a living organism. We think about it as a body, a whole family system as a body, and that it's incomplete if that whole family system isn't intact. The nuclear family isn't what I'm talking about. The extended family of 3-4 generations, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandmas, grandpas, great-grandmas, grand-aunts, and so on, as the repository of a whole lot of skills in terms of how to do community, how to be community, and how to be community on the land, in terms of how you treat the land and how you take care of it and how you take care of each other without destroying it and how you move that along. And so family systems, if they're fragmented into non-family systems, because I don't count a nuclear family as a family. It's a mother and father and children. And even they don't stay together in this society. There's a diaspora because of the market economy. You have to move over here for a job. You have to move over there or around the other end of the world. And so family really doesn't exist. It does not exist. There's a yearning for it and a hunger for it and a need for it, a much deeper need than we think and that we know. In terms of our indigenous community, family is survival, is the basis of survival. And you cannot operate community without family. Community doesn't exist without extended family systems. Otherwise, it's just a collection of strangers, people that are not cooperating, not collaborating, not loving each other, not taking care of each other over generations and generations and learning how to do that on the land. So there's no communities either. And so one of the things about giving, and I'll give you some quick examples about that in family systems, our family systems in our communities are like clan systems. And each family system, extended family system, usually has a role of work in the community. Just like maybe something like long ago, the guilds in Europe, where you had the bakers and the millers and, you know, so on and so on. And huge families passed down that, you know, skill to the next family, and they used that skill to contribute to the community. Well, in our system, those extended families are the repositories of different kinds of skills. There are medicine families, there are the healer families. Medicine families and healer families usually are similar, but one you could say are biologists, ethnobotanists, the healer families. The medicine families are the psychologists, psychiatrists, and usually part of the chief's family belongs to that, because they have to be psychologists and psychiatrists. And the chief's families, and then the people that are hunter families or fishermen or basket makers and so on, those families all have people in them that are conversant with all of those different tools that our community needs to continue on its life cycles. One of the things about gift giving in ours is we're very similar in our traditions to the West Coast tradition, in that we have a huge number of feasts during the year. My mother was a longhouse leader, a winter dance leader, we call it in our community, because, of course, we don't have big cedars like the West Coast, or so we have short houses. And we have winter dances in the winter time. And the winter dances are similar to the smokehouse, big house dances on the West Coast, in that they're giveaways. And I grew up with my uncle being a medicine man, my mother being a medicine woman, and a winter house leader, dance leader. All of our extended families spent all year long, cousins, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren, gathering and making and putting aside things that are to be given away during that winter dance. And every year during that winter dance, your mother gives away everything she owns. And without question, without choosing, without deciding how that's, who it's to be given to, it's simply given in a 10-day ritual of dance. And that I saw all my life. And I was brought up with all my life. We were told by my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, and my uncles that giving is the only way to be human. That if you don't know that giving is essential to survival, then you haven't been civilized yet. That you don't know how to be human yet. And that we're told that once we understand, when we're growing up, when we're like 2 or 3 years old, the very first things we're taught is to give. In those ceremonies, the very first things that we're shown how to do is to give. That when we receive something that we really cherish and we really like and we really care about, that's the first thing we should give. Because our community is to be cherished on that level. Our people and our land is to be cherished on that level. And if you don't know how to give like that, you're poor. You're in poverty. You might hoard all the things that you think your family or your community or your business needs, but you're poor. My mother used to drive through some of the cities, and she'd look out there and she'd say, those poor people, those poor, poor people. And she meant it. She wasn't being ironic or sarcastic. She was pointing out what they were missing out on. She was pointing out what they are hungry for and what they're trying to find in accumulating and hoarding and being selfish. She was pointing out what is really, really given to you when you reverse that, and what you feel when you give. You all know that feeling. When you give of purity, you all know how good it makes you feel and how great it makes you as a person inside. You all know that feeling. That is a natural feeling to us as humans. That is the real feeling of being human. And we all feel that when we do that. Christmas time, everybody's so excited about getting and giving and giving, you know, and some people go overboard. Where do you think that feeling comes from? When we give to our loved ones, you know, we're used to just giving to our favorite chosen loved ones in this outer society. Without realizing that you feel the same in giving, whether it's your direct blood relative or whether it's a stranger absolutely not known to you, the feeling is the same. And in one of our laws, we're told that when we start understanding that principle and we start working with that principle and we source that principle, we lead our lives by giving continuously, never ever thinking about what you get back from it or exchanging it for something that you want somebody to do for you. In fact, that's not called giving in our language. In our language, that's called something else. We call it kamila. There's no word for greed in our language that I could... I've tried to find a word for greed in our language, and there isn't a word. What we found instead is that word kamila, and we use it to mean a person that... expecting to get something back or expecting to have more than another and expecting to eat more than another, you know, and we describe people as becoming that, and we call them an esnashkiluhten in our language. And what that means is a destructor of people, destroyer of people. In our traditions, we had a way to be able to describe that, because what kamila means is to be able to stop the giving. Ka means to stop, and mil means to give. You give out. It goes out to wherever it goes. Kamila means to stop the giving, to put an obstacle between the giving and yourself. And so we describe a person as kamila if they want more for themselves or they want more for their family or if they, you know, in some way act as an obstacle by being selfish to the rest of everybody getting what, you know, is necessary and needed and deserved by them. In terms of someone's talk on languages here, I want to tell you that my language is one of the languages that's on the brink of extinction. And these words that I'm describing to you are immensely important words that belong in the understanding of our humanity and that are necessary and needed in the understanding of what needs to be done to change. And in our way, we are always told not to ask for anything. We're always told in our community as a practice that when you start asking for something, that's when you're agreeing that people are being irresponsible in not understanding what your need is, not seeing what your need is, and not making sure that they have moved their resources and their actions toward making sure that need isn't there. Because that's the responsibility of people that surround you. So you in our community, you cannot ask. You cannot go to a person and say, I want you to do this for me, I want you to do that for me. All you can do is clarify for them what is happening and what the consequences are in your family or your community or on your land. Clarify for them and clarify for them what needs to be done and how it needs to be done. And then it's up to them. And if they fall short of that responsibility, that at some point they will face the same need themselves, that they will be in that kind of need. And we're told on a spiritual level that when we give, and you can try this in your own life, when you give freely without asking for anything back, whatever it might be, especially the things that are really difficult for you to give, that you receive back the equivalent of four times whatever it is that you gave. And it's a simple exercise that my mother used to tell me. She used to tell me, whatever you have to work now to in order to put food on the table, whatever you work for, you keep, you know, a small amount, enough to put food on the table and enough to get you back and forth to work, and you give all the rest away. And you make sure you continue to do that every year, and you'll never have to worry about your work. You'll never have to worry about, you know, all of the things that you need to cover that. And I never have. And I do that every year of my life, all the time, to my community, to my people, to strangers, to everything that I do. If I were asked to come here to speak on this topic without the giving of the organizers here, and I saw that it was something that could be given to change the way things happen, I would find a way to give that. And I would find a way to come here to do that. And I have done that and practiced that. And I think that's something that is needed in terms of how we do things. I think that's something that needs to be understood in terms of our personal. So I've taken it from the land to the community to the family to the personal level. It comes down to each person embodying that and practicing that and doing that without let up. It comes down to each person being human in that way. Thank you.
Jeanette Armstrong speaking at the 2004 conference on the gift economy in Las Vegas. See www.gifteconomyconference.com.